recorder on now.
Thank you.
I'll go ahead and let you, in fact, it sounds like it, it's already running. So tell me your question again.
So we say that the Buddha teaches only dukkha, dukkha nirodha. However, I believe the Mahayana would have an additional point on top of that. Is that dukkha, dukkha nirodha isn't the full thing, but there's still an extra point beyond arhatship. Because when we say someone who's come to the end of dukkha is an arhat, but then the Mahayana, they don't have that ideal. They have what they call the bodhisattva, right? And I've heard you say before that that's sort of the ideal, that we have to clean out our own minds and then we have to sort of clean out other people's minds.
Well, not with a scalpel. Hello, Carl. Welcome to our group.
Thank you. Pleasure. Good day, everyone.
All right. So, David, let's see if we can put some light on that. First off, the Buddha called himself a bodhisattva before he became a Buddha. He refers to himself before that as a bodhisattva. The term of bodhisattva actually has the direct meaning of one who seeks bodhi. It's the seeker. It's the one who has not yet become enlightened. So the question that you have is kind of backwards in the sense that bodhisattva is one beyond the arahat. Oh, no, everyone here is a bodhisattva. Now, there is a kind of a story or a tradition that is part of the Mahayana that has to do with that the bodhisattva will hang back and not go all the way in so that he can help those who have not gone in yet. Then, in fact, the bodhisattva vow is that may all beings become enlightened before me. All right, so now we have five here bodhisattvas, and we're the last ones before the rest of them, all they've gone in. And so all we have to do is, okay, David, it's your turn. Get in there. I'm going to be the last one. And then Michael says, oh, no, you get in, Damaranto. I'm going to be the last one. And we wind up having a fist fight over who's the last one to go in. All right. Why? Because none of the bodhisattvas are fully enlightened yet. Now the whole point is that the door is not a one-way door. That in fact, it's an open door, and that you can go in and then come back out and spread joy and become a bodhisattva, and then you can go haul your butt back in to nothing. What's wrong with that? Why does it have to be a door that is a one-way door, that once you become completely enlightened, you cannot help other people? The Buddha did. That, in fact, his point was, number one, ain't nobody going to understand this stuff. It's too profound. It's too difficult. Everybody is stuck in samsara. Everybody is stuck in sensuality. And they're not going to understand that they can just drop it. And then he said, well, maybe I've got a couple of friends I know of. For instance, who was it? Okay, Ramaranaputta, but then he had died. And Alama Kalama had also died. But yet he still got off of his butt in Bodh Gaya and walked, 75 kilometers or so to the Deer Park at Isitanya to teach his five old friends. And guess what? They saw him coming. They saw that he had gotten fat. And they didn't want to have anything to do with him until they finally allowed him to teach. And then the first thing that he said to them was about the middle path between sensuality and, let us say, flagellation, or doing harm to ourselves, bringing on dukkha. So the sensuality is actually out looking for dukkha, and then the flagellation is finding it. And we've got a middle path. And that middle path is the dukkha, dukkha, nirodha. And that path is available every moment to every person. And yet many, many Asians and all of the Westerners seem to have a bottom line goal-oriented mentality, in the sense of once you go through that door, you can't come back out. I've also recently heard a Western Theravada monk talk about, and back to basically what he was doing is he was trash-talking all the arahats in the West who claimed that they're arahats. But he had a couple of very interesting things to say. And that was that an arahat himself gets really, 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 totally, 100% plus one, lazy. That when someone is fully an arahat, they don't want to shave, they don't want to eat, that taking a bath is too much for them, that's too much dukkha. Taking a breath is almost too much. I'd rather sit here and just pass out because breathing is too much work. Now, that's kind of an extreme position for that monk to have taken. Now, think about it for yourself. How far into the Dhamma do you want to go? How much dukkha do you want to finish? Do you want 100% of no dukkha left? Because the only way you're going to get that is by being dead. That even an arahat has to breathe. Even an arahat has to adjust his robe. Even an arahat has to take a walk. Because one of the young monks is going to pick him up, give him his cane, and tell him to take a walk. That's what happened, by the way, to Bhikkhu Buddhadasa. They'd make him walk. Take him for a walk every morning. So, we're actually now looking at it from where is the extreme and why? Because the Buddha is always a really excellent example. The Buddha cared enough, just enough, caring. The only thing that he cared about, in fact, was the Dhamma and the spreading of the Dhamma, which is exactly what the Bodhisattva is supposed to be according to the Mahayana concept. Is that we stay around long enough to teach the Dhamma, and everybody else, once they become enlightened and find out that they don't have to do nothing, I'll find a way to do nothing too. But until I have everybody doing nothing, I've got work to do to try to teach everybody to stop doing and start doing nothing. Somewhere in there, you can see that there is a logical twist going on, a logical fallacy. Well, the logical fallacy probably will never come about because we're not ever going to get everybody to become enlightened. We can't even get everybody to visit the temple. We can't even get everybody to join our website. We can't get everybody to practice Anapanasati. We can't even get them to start laughing at Donald Trump. Everybody's either hating him or in love with him, but nobody's laughing at him, and he's the best comedian in town. So you see that we're a long way from that. In fact, one of the questions that comes by is that, well, if everybody was a monk or a nun, then where would the human race be in 35 or 40 years? No more children. All the monks got old, and all the human race is either a monk or a nun, and they're all now old and decrepit. In fact, Japan's got that kind of problem automatically. That in fact, when women stop having babies, the population is going to decline. So when you're that bodhisattva waiting for the last end where everybody is already through the gate, most of them went through the gates already dead. You got the biggest cemetery you ever saw. Somewhere in there is a logical fallacy, you see. And that logical fallacy never meets up because no one is, there are not that many people interested in the teachings of the Buddha. So the number of arahats that actually exist are quite rare. How does everybody who puts on a yellow robe and speaks English think they know what an arahat is when they probably have, when they were around them, didn't recognize one? And the better way to do that is by giving people the benefit of the doubt. For instance, before we started the call, we were talking about Achan Po. And one of us here mentioned that he's as perfect as anyone. And he's not perfect. He's not a perfect human being. He's just good enough to hold it in high regard. And now we can come back to the point of what the Buddha first taught. The very first thing he taught was middle path. That dukkha is going to be found at either extreme, either in sensuality or in flagellation. Yeah, S&M. Doing stuff to harm ourselves. Like the dog chasing a bus. What is he going to do when he catches the bus? He's out it for the run. He doesn't intend to catch the bus. He's just intended to chase it. So, in that regard, why can't you just be in the chase for dukkha or dukkha nirodha? Knowing that you'll probably never catch it. You'll never come to the point that there's absolutely no more dukkha, but we can come to the point that there is good enough.
There's dukkha and wanting dukkha nirodha to be permanent.
Yes, exactly. Everything, remember the teaching of the Buddha, is everything is temporary. Dukkha is temporary, dukkha nirodha is temporary. Everything is temporary. You're temporary. I'm temporary. This conversation is temporary. The glass of water you just drank is temporary. I know, I just emptied mine. All right, everything is temporary. So this idea of there is something beyond dukkha, dukkha, nirodha, yes, there's good old nothing. Then, in fact, these kind of questions that you've asked means that you haven't seen nothing yet. Because when you see nothing, there's nothing to it. Then, in fact, nothingness is kind of the bottom line, after all, anyway. And it's still part of the middle path, because at the end of one extreme is something, and at the other end of the other extreme is something else. But right in the middle, there's nothing there.
I see what you're saying, but I've spoken to some people that are, I guess, right into the Mahayana path, and they say even though there might be nothing there, there's still like additional steps. That
there's additional nothing.
There's still
there's more than nothing.
Yeah, this is what confuses me too.
All right. Yeah. Does that not have the quality of my Dhamma is better than your Dhamma? My Mahayana is better than your Theravada.
Yeah, we hear this a lot, right?
Mm-hmm. And the reality is that when both of them are practicing correctly, it's the same. It's the same everywhere. Dhamma is just Dhamma. And that is dukkha, dukkha, nirodha. So you're not going to find the Mahayana bodhisattva, arahat kind of guy saying that. You're going to hear it from the students, from the children. from those who are still into comparing my Dhamma is better than your Dhamma, because the further one gets into Dhamma, the more they recognize that there's just nothing else but Dhamma. That's all there is. How can one Dhamma be better than another Dhamma? How can Mahayana Dhamma be better than Theravada Dhamma when Dhamma is just Dhamma? And then the thing that you were pointing out, that, oh, Bodhisattva is better than Arahat. I've heard that. But isn't the Arahat the one that goes through the gate and sits down and enjoys his life, and the Bodhisattva is the one that keeps trying to herd all the cattle into through the gate? They even have a little poem, gate, parasam gate. I don't think they're talking about gate, though. That's an English word. What it really means is gone beyond. Just gone, which means there's nothing much left. So, can the one who has nothing much left still teach the Dhamma, or is he incapable of teaching the Dhamma? He's actually incapable of even adjusting his road or shaving or perhaps even eating, because he doesn't want any dukkha. Doesn't that actually, by not wanting any dukkha at all, create dukkha? I mean, we do have an obligation to the Dhamma. We have a few things that we need to do. An example of that is I take a bath when I'm told to take a bath. But sometimes Arahats stink because they don't take a bath. Why? Because it's too much trouble. How can you possibly get an Arahat to teach you anything? That, in fact, this is one of the points about, it happens mostly in Zen, but you'll see it in other places, that the old monk is so satisfied and so content with everything, and he's okay, so that when the students ask him detailed questions like this, all he's going to give them is a grunt or a one-word answer, or maybe a koan, like the sound of one jaw slapping or something like that. Right? So when you run across these old monks who don't bother to teach, they'll give you a word or two of advice, but that's all you get. You don't get a full Dhamma talk from them because they couldn't be bothered. But most of these guys who are out there saying that the Bodhisattva is higher than the Arahat is like saying that the worldly side of that gate is better than the other world that's beyond this world. And so they've kind of got that whole idea about the Bodhisattva backwards. What they don't really understand is that the gate is an open gate, and you can go hang out in nothingness, and then you can come back and jawbone about it. Then you can go back and hang out in nothingness some more, and then you can come back and grab somebody by the arm and throw them into nothingness. But it's this mentality that people have about dualities, of that there is absolutely the world and everybody's struggling, and then there's this other world where there's only an Arahat and Arahats don't do anything. But then they've got this issue about the Bodhisattva that's standing at the gate, trying to get people to go through the gate, but he won't go in himself. Let's fight. Go ahead. You go in first. So, David, a response, please.
Yeah, often I hear a criticism of the Theravada from the Mahayana about the Arhat is just like this complacent, passive person. He's just too satisfied to do anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. But don't they call the Buddha an Arahat, and isn't he the top dog of their group? I just don't get their position. Other than, my Dhamma is better than your Dhamma. That's all I really hear in that. Is that, oh, we change enough of the terminology so that we can make ourselves feel good because our Dhamma is better than yours. And what do they have besides the Arahat? They've got the Bodhisattva, and it's already been demonstrated that the Bodhisattva, in fact, is not an Arahat. And they forget that they've got that duality, rather than recognizing that someone can be an Arahat in the morning and a Bodhisattva in the morning and an Arahat in the afternoon. That happens at Thai temples on a regular basis. The lay people come and they get advice, and then when they go home at lunchtime or after lunch, now we got nothing to do all day. So the practicality is that it's an open door, and one can pass in and out. It's almost a Western mentality that brings in that duality that you're either in or you're out. And then which is the higher, the one that's already gone through the gate and he's out of it, or the one who is still on this side of the gate trying to grab people and shove them through? Because after all, the Bodhisattva really does want to become completely and fully enlightened. He's just waiting for everybody else to do it. Oh, poor him. Oh, poor Bodhisattva. All them people are just such laggards. They're into sensuality, and they won't do what I tell them to do. And I'm in a hurry to become enlightened. So these Mahayana, they have kind of an issue when they try to say that the Bodhisattva is better than the Arahat, when in fact, I don't see the duality. Does anybody else, how about you, Michael 1 or Michael 2, Messenger? Do you see any duality in their this Mahayana concept? Turn your mic on.
One thing I'm finding interesting about this is that it almost seems like the Bodhisattva has a bit of a do as I say, not as I do mentality. Instead of just doing as what the Bodhisattva would say to do. And how can the Bodhisattva truly teach what to do if they're not doing it?
Wow, that's a door closer. Case closed.
Yeah, how can the Bodhisattva save all beings when it's really, you can't really save other beings. You can't really clean other people's minds up.
Yeah, right? You can't do it for them either way anyways. Yeah.
The person has to.
Just downright busy. Maybe they're busy chasing you around the gate. So where's all of these Mahayana folks anyway? I don't see any Mahayanas at the Theravada Wat that you're in.
No, they're not monks, just friends from back home.
Okay. Wait a minute. So you're not hearing this from Mahayana Thai people. You're not even hearing it from Tibetan people. You're hearing this from Westerners way back at home.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's the whole point that I'm trying to make here is that Westerners really don't understand that they're creating a conflict that doesn't really exist. In the name of my Dhamma is better than your Dhamma. My dog's better than your dog because I feed him better. You know, kind of mentality.
It's a different view. Not necessarily that.
It's a view.
It's
better. Right. It is a view. It's a position.
Right. Not necessarily attached to that position, though.
Well, I know that you're not.
Or,
but you're talking about a group of people who are attached to that kind of position.
Potentially, they're not, actually. But maybe they just have it as a view and they see it as better. It's just their view that it's better and they're not really attached to it whether or not it is better, but they have it as a view.
Well, when you drop those kind of views, there's not much left, is there? So those views are actually heavy.
Don't we need some sort of view to sort of function in this reality?
No, you need to look at what's real without claiming that you know what's real. You just keep looking, okay? Mm-hmm. So in fact, there's two kinds of views. Let's start with it like this. There's two different kinds of investigations. One is the investigation like Sherlock Holmes, and there he is with his great big magnifying glass and his pipe and his crazy hat, and he's out there and he's looking. And then there's another kind of investigation, which is a folder full of papers in a file drawer. That's also an investigation, which means then there is an open investigation of looking, and then there is a closed-minded, completed investigation that's called a concept, a view. In that regard, view is a noun. It's like a folder. It's like a completed investigation. They've got the answer now. Thank you very much. We know that bodhisattvas are better than arahats. Case closed. Guess what? Ain't no case and nothing is closed. Right now, it's still open. Let's keep looking. Let's continue to investigate without coming to conclusions, because whatever conclusion you come to is going to be wrong when things change. The only thing that doesn't change, in fact, is conclusions. And the only place you'll find conclusions is in the mind. So the mind is the only thing that doesn't change. Everything else, all of reality, keeps changing. And that's just a view. Let's drop all views, all worldviews, all positions, all rights and all wrongs, and just keep investigating, just keep looking. That's the teaching of the Buddha, rather than getting into arguments with Mahayana and their views. Let's just destroy their views, turn them into nothing, and now nobody's got any views left.
That was the Buddhist.
And that's my view. Wait a minute. Let me look again. Right, that's how it is. At least again. See, that's the whole point is that we try to come to conclusions that we know something. So in fact, the right way to look at it is that I don't know nothing. Let me look again. Dukkha sneaks up on people who think that they know where it is. Let's stay alert. The joke is that the world needs more alerts. Stay alert. Did anybody get that joke? Think about it, Michael. Yeah, so let's all be alert. So let's stay alert. Let's stay watching. Let's not come to conclusions. David, you didn't get that joke?
Stay alert.
Stay alert. The world needs more alerts. They need more people who are alert.
See,
the distinction is that alert is a verb that I'm using, but the way that I'm saying it makes it sound like a noun. Alert, Mr. Lert, as opposed to being awake, staying alert.
No.
That's my second best Buddhist joke. My first one is, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Or there's nothing to it.
Yeah, there's nothing to it. That's it. So are we, go ahead, David.
Well, that was, I said,
okay. He was lip syncing. Sorry, Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, I can't speak directly to the Mahayana view because I've never really gone too far down that road. But my perspective is that, like, you know, even the, like, any tradition post, you know, historical Buddha, including aspects of the Theravada tradition that come from the commentaries and things like that, are coping mechanisms of failed Buddhists, essentially, because, you know, what the Buddha points out to us is that if we look directly at experience, and we assume nothing beyond experience, that, you know, the five aggregates, the six sense bases, the four foundations are the constituents of our experience, and that, you know, dukkha is a phenomenon that appears and disappears within experience. And if we just mm-hmm. keep our view just on that, there's no need to assume a materialist metaphysics or, like, or an idealist metaphysics, or assume anything essentially outside of the five aggregates. And what assumes the five aggregates, what takes possession of the five aggregates, is craving. And then, you know, craving creates a sense of ownership. So it's sort of passion mm-hmm. and identity that assumes the five aggregates. So the bodhisattva ideal is a passion and an identity. So it's sort of a way of having your cake and eating it too, kind of a Buddhism, mm-hmm. like, where, okay, I'm going to be this very important person who's, like, seen or, like, experienced nirvana but didn't go into non-existence, because it's also based on a misunderstanding of what nirvana is, because, you know, nirvana is just the cooling down of the fire. Like, the aggregates are on fire due to that passion, that craving that assumes the aggregates. Mm-hmm. That's what lights the aggregates on fire, and nirvana is just that fire going out. The aggregates remain, the activity of nature remains. It's just that assumption of that activity that goes out. So there's really nothing to fear, but people fear it. So that's kind of my perspective.
Right. Here's something. Why do you think that the Buddha taught about the five aggregates? Let's name them specifically, of body, feeling, and then the mind is broken into three groups of consciousness, perception, and sankhara. Why do you think that he taught that concept? The answer is because there is no aggregate self anywhere in that mix. You are not the body. You are not the feelings. And so the language of I feel tired, or I feel anxious, or I feel frustrated, or I'm uptight, all of that is a misnomer, because there may be frustration, but I'm not frustrated. Why? Because there's nothing much there to me. Nothing to it. So that's the reason that the five aggregates were taught, is that the body, there is no self in the body. There is no self in consciousness. There is no self in all of that junk that we carry around from the past, the sankharas. There is no self in the feelings. And there is no self in the way we make stuff up, which is perception. That's the real teaching. And in fact, the five aggregates are an excellent introduction into Paticca-Samuppada, where you start with, there was no self to begin with. And that the reason why we think that there's a self is because we ignorantly understand the instinct, the self-preservation instinct, that deep instinct inside that wants to preserve this organism's being alive is often mistaken for the self. The self is actually a concept to where self-preservation instinct is a reality. But the way that we see the self-preservation instinct causes or creates a self. And the, one of the places that you can find that, by the way, that that's the kind of the whole point of the simile of the snake. When you read past the simile of the snake and you read past the simile of the raft, and then you get into that part of the sutta where he talks about both formerly and now, I teach only one thing, dukkha, dukkha, nirodha, and after that, the rest of the sutta is the five aggregates to say that it's the self that causes dukkha. Because of that stupidity that we have, that I'm exist, I'm important. The bodhisattva then thinks that he's important. Where in fact going through the gate means that we finally figured out we're not important at all. It doesn't matter. Let the world do what the world's going to do. I can't save it. I don't even want to save the world. I'm having trouble taking a bath. Standing up and walking.
People misunderstand what the aggregates are, and they misunderstand what the self, what self is in regard to the five aggregates, or just in general.
Exactly. You know,
the aggregates are the constituents of experience: form, feeling, perception, thinking, consciousness. It's everything that makes up experience. Self is a concept, just like a view.
Concept.
It's something that we bring into existence, meaning something that the mind creates separate from the aggregates.
Precisely.
And because something that has been created as apart from the aggregates, that's why the idea of birth, aging, and death is created. That's why suffering is created as soon as the self is created, because all of a sudden you stand apart from the aggregates. When the aggregates are just the activity of nature, and only when the mind creates something apart from that activity does the sense of birth, aging, illness, and death come into experience.
Right. Okay. So, to go back to that point that David was making, then we can see that the bodhisattva and the bodhisattva ideal is nothing but a concept that has a self in it. The arahat, for almost all people, is just another concept. The arahat is a concept, and nobody knows when they've seen one, right? Because the arahat is not out advertising, I'm an arahat. He's too busy doing nothing. So we still have to deal with all of these concepts, but the concepts are all built around a self. Like, who is it that's an arahat? That's, in fact, one of the questions that became famous around Watsuan Mok, when some Westerner walks in there and says, are you enlightened? Bhikkhu Buddha Das says, what his answer was, who or what is it that can be enlightened? Enlightenment is just a concept. The arahat is just another concept. The bodhisattva is just another concept.
The arahat can be a concept, or in terms of the way that patujanas, or people still living as egos, think of an arahat. But the way that the Buddha used those terms was just as ways of testing the success of his problem and solution. Like, the Buddha didn't try to teach any kind of absolute or metaphysical truth. He identified the problem of dukkha and then gave us the solution. And then you could test along the way, just like with the scientific method. Okay, this amount of bonds have been broken. This amount of beliefs have been uprooted. So I'm a Sotapanna now.
Exactly.
These other two have been weakened. I'm a Sakadagami. Now these five have been eliminated. That's what he would call an anagami. And then, okay, all of the fetters no longer are present in the mind. This is an arahat. So it's just a way of testing the pragmatism of the path. But in the way that we discuss it, it's a concept and an identity. And like the notion that an arahat would not be active at all is based on the fact that everything we do is based on passion and identity. Mm-hmm. And the Arahat has no passion or identity, but the Arahat has wisdom. And then so every action is governed by wisdom rather than emotion.
Right, exactly. And that wisdom then is based upon one's duty to the Dhamma, mm-hmm. or another way of saying our duty to reality. Can we do our duty to Dhamma? Can we do our duty into reality without having feelings about it? Like the Arahat who doesn't want to take a bath and doesn't want to shave, got feelings about not wanting to do anything. And so I suspect this guy may not be an Arahat after all, because by not doing his duty to the Dhamma, he's demonstrating that he's got resistance to doing his duty to the Dhamma. And there's another one that's very interesting that goes back to what David was talking about in the beginning. One who is an Arahat doesn't compare. The word in Pali, by the way, is mm-hmm. mana, and it has to do mm-hmm. with competing or competition. Well, the Arahat's too busy not doing anything to compete.
Measurement.
To measure. Like what's a bear hot and what's a Damagami and what's a Bodhisattva and all of that kind of stuff. But I would like to change the subject just slightly and start to look at a couple of words. The Mahayana and the Hinayana, which, by the way, is a concept of the Mahayanas. That in fact, I even know of a monk. In fact, I lived with a Mahasamsak, and the first time he said that, I was really surprised. But after that, I got a load of it because it was a joke. When he called himself Hinayana, because the Mahayanas thinks that the word Hinayana is a derogatory term. Oh, we've got the big boat. The word Yana, by the way, is a boat. Have you heard that, David? Mahayana is the big boat. And the Theravada is Hinayana, which means a little boat. Okay, well, let's look at something for just a second.
Actually, I heard the Theravada isn't considered part of the Hinayana. This is what I heard. That a Hinayana refers to like an older school of Buddhism than like the early school of Buddhism before Theravada.
Well, there never was a school called Hinayana, and all the Mahayanas that I know of will point directly at a Theravada and say, Hinayana, Hinayana!
Okay.
Okay. So let's examine the thing from the perspective of a boat, a big boat. Okay? A big boat, like an aircraft carrier, or maybe a cruise liner, or maybe a passenger ship, right? What happens to the passengers on a passenger ship? They have to book in advance. They have to stand in line with all of their goodies and all of their baggage. They have to spend a long time on that boat. And guess what? They have no choice over where that boat goes. They're passengers. And not only that, but let us now look at it, the fact that it's a big, like I forgot the word that they used for the Roman ships that had all of these oars, right? And yet, nobody's willing to oar. I'm a passenger here. I should not have to stoke the fire. I don't have to row, all right? This is the Mahayana. You're supposed to get on the boat, and the boat's going to take you to wherever you're supposed to go, and you don't have much choice about it. This is a big boat. Now let's look at a little boat. You could get in the darn thing anytime you want to. There it is. You got to paddle it yourself. You got to put in the right effort. And guess what? You can go where you want to go. That in fact, you can do a great deal of distance while all of those Mahayana passengers are standing in line trying to get on the boat. In that regard, I kind of prefer a little boat. Think about it like that, and then you'll recognize that, wait a minute, everybody to get on the big boat probably had to take a little boat to get to the big boat in the first place. They had to walk or do something on their own. And then, in fact, that's the actual teaching of the Buddha, is that it is a little raft. It is, you got to cross that shore, you got to build your own raft, you got to paddle yourself over there. And the whole idea of a Mahayana got started from the Mahasangha, which happened in the time of King Asoka, where there were too many people who became Buddhist monks because it became a royal patronage. And King Asoka built monasteries, he built wats, he gave room, he gave robes, he gave bowls, he would feed the monks. Even the conference that was held in the capital city of Rajgiri, and all the arahats, the real gurus who knew what the Buddha was teaching, were overwhelmed by all of these brand new monks who were mostly still Brahmin or whatever group that they were coming from. And so the arahats didn't have the time or the effort or the energy to teach. It's very much like, imagine a big university, say that's got 10,000 students and maybe a faculty of 500, all of a sudden now has 100,000 students, but you've got the same faculty. The students wind up going to class and teaching themselves. And so they had a conference, and the only ones who were allowed into the conference were the arahats. Well, now, how's an arahat going to test an arahat? How do they know? What kind of questions are they going to ask to figure out who's an arahat and who's not? How would you test? Michael, Clark, how would you test if you were going to be the gatekeeper that kept only the arahats in and let them in, and only the all the other students couldn't come in? How would you test? What kind of questions would you ask?
I would just ask them, are you an arhat?
Yeah, and then you've got a million in there, because they're all going to say I'm an arhat. Maybe the only ones you let in are the ones who answer that question of what's an arhat?
Yeah.
Who or what's an arhat? Okay. So that conference was held. There is, by the way, questions that you can ask that only a Sotapan or better will know the answer to. As far as what the arahats ask each other, I'm not sure, other than that one that Bhikkhu Buddhadasa answered. Yeah, well, who cares?
They have no questions.
Yeah, is that a question? Exactly.
I was going to say that they have no questions.
Yeah.
Arahats, question. They don't have any questions.
Mm-hmm. So, in this case, though, somehow or another, the arahats got into this meeting, and all the rest of them couldn't get in. So what do you think they did? They had their own conference, a big one. This was probably the beginning, then, of the Hinayana, because the Mahayana, or the Mahasangha, was all of those monks who couldn't get in. So.
FOMO.
Almost, yeah.
No, FOMO. I said FOMO. Fear of missing out, FOMO.
Uh-huh. So this was the actual beginning of the division or the split. But that doesn't mean that there are no arahats in the Mahayana tradition, but it's those who go around making distinctions between the Mahayana and the Theravada. You can pretty well understand that that's a concept that this guy holds. So this was the actual beginning of the Mahayana, was during the time of King Asoka. It didn't start in Tibet. A lot of people think that all Mahayana was started in other countries. Oh no, it lasted in India for 300 or 400 years. The Mahayana was part of the Indian culture. So we can look at it from the perspective of there's really no reason for us to continue to see a distinction between Theravada, Hinayana, and Mahayana. because we're all passengers of a really big ship. And at the same time, we're all having to row our own boat. We are all
There's not even such a thing as Buddhism. You know,
well, I'm not
I mean, the Buddha, he...
Well, those taught, Buddhists, they're taught, like Christians. The wow, what a stench.
he called what he taught the sublime way of life. He didn't call it Buddhism. And the sublime way of life is the Noble Eightfold Path. So, I mean, you can call it, you know, you can call it the Dhamma, the Noble Eightfold Path, sublime way of life. But any concept of there being a Buddhism other than that is definitely false.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's Theravada.
Right. In a way, there's no such thing as Christianity. Mm-hmm. Especially since they don't follow the teachings of Jesus. How can they become Christians or be Christians if they're not even, I mean, racism and national Christian nationalism and border issues and all of that is definitely not what Jesus taught. So we could go so far then to say is that Buddhist and Buddhism are all of those people who really don't understand the teaching of the Buddha, but they still give him credit. To where those who really understand the teaching of the Buddha say, thank you very much, but you're dead. I really appreciate that you've left this legacy. Wow, am I so grateful. But I understand that the Buddha died. Probably from food poisoning. It's in the Mahaparinibbana Sutra number 16 of the Dinga Nikaya, but that comes from older literature. Most of it is from the Udana. But the point is that there is no reason to bow and to scrape and all of that, that most of the bowing and the scraping that Christians hate about the Buddhist is actually tradition. It's the respect that they paid to kings to keep their heads attached to their shoulders. But the bowing and scraping, yeah, I went along with it. I was a monk for all of those years. I did all of that bowing and scraping, and I did it knowing that it's just a ritual. Nothing to it. Doesn't mean a thing.
You gotta, when you don't have craving, you need something to do that isn't governed by craving. So, you know, there's a way of life to follow, gives you something to do. And that's...
So... five precepts, bowing and scraping, taking vows, all of that kind of stuff is what Buddhists do. But Dhamma dudes know that when they're doing that, that it doesn't mean a thing.
Totally irrelevant.
Totally irrelevant. The question is, are you happy doing what you're doing right now? But back to the one point that I want to make, and that is there really is no distinction between Mahayana and Theravada or Hinayana, that we've all got to paddle our own boat. But we want to do it when there's a whole lot of other people around. We want that Mahayana. We want friends. We want Sangha. But in fact, that's the way to think about the Mahayana, the big boat, is just all my buddies. And everybody's paddling their own little craft. But together, wow, what an armada. But everybody's got to do his own thing. Everybody's got to put in the right noble effort to come out of the dukkha. And so we all tend to go off in the same direction, which is the dukkha back there, and we're going this way. So, Carl, do you have anything to say? You've been quite silent for this little talk.
No, I find it really fascinating. And also regarding the, there shouldn't really be any distinction in the Dharma, right? This it's almost funny because a lot of Mahayana talks about being you know, non-dual versus dual, and that, you know, that's the better. But that's actually very dualistic, very dualistic language.
Yes, it is. Yeah, non-duality is actually a duality.
Yeah,
having the distinction between duality and non-duality is a duality.
Yeah, exactly. When you use that as a opposite, you know, as a, you know, as a position, especially, which I hear a lot, that, you know, our Dhamma is better because we're non-dual, but then you're very dual right at that concept. But,
yeah, you just created a duality, and we're not in your part of the
I hear a lot of that from really, you know, I don't know, maybe, see, I come a little bit from a Vajrayana, that was my inroad, you know, but I think you should, I don't think they emphasize a lot on the Theravada anymore. Like, that was much, very much more important, I think. Maybe in Western Buddhism, you just go straight into whatever is your, but I think you should always really, that's why I'm coming into to also your dialogues, and because it really gives really a profound grounding in the Dhamma, you know.
Mm-hmm. You're right. In fact, I agree that distinction of we're Mahayana and you're not, you're Theravada, and we're unified and we have unity and you create duality, all of that mentality and those concepts, I think, is beginning to seep in. That the Mahayana
so
that
dual.
Wants to, yeah, the ones who want to create duality by talking about that we're non-dual, they're beginning to recognize that that's a logical fallacy.
It's,
you hear a lot of it.
You know what image comes to mind? It's like there's a building on fire, and three different fire departments have shown up, and they're all waiting for the other one to put the fire out. You know, they're like, you know, which one of us, which fire hose and which water is going to put that fire out? You know, it's like, well, no, just put the fire out. Like, you just here to put the fire out. It's not, doesn't matter like what fire department you're from.
Well, I'm not going to put your fire out. That's your fire. Okay.
Perhaps
guys.
A person's on fire.
Well, back to David. I see you've been moving around from your boulders to your room now. Carl, your mic is a little noisy. Can you cut it back off? All right, thanks. So what do you think, David, about this concept of duality and Mahayana and all of that? I mean, you were Theravada up until you started talking an hour ago, defending the Mahayana. Your microphone is muted.
Sorry, you said I was Theravada up until I started talking an hour ago?
I'm not teaching you. Well, you were defending Mahayana.
Oh, no, not defending. No. I'm just sort of wondering.
But the Mahayana have bodhisattvas. Anyway.
Right.
There's a slight distinction in there. I'm not accusing you of anything. Sorry. I'm teasing you. You mentioned the Mahayanas. What do you think now that we've had this talk? How would you answer, this is a good question, how would you answer the Mahayana the next time they bring this topic up?
It's sort of like, yeah, they're making a duality, or they're saying one Dhamma is better than another Dhamma, when really it's the same Dhamma, right?
Yeah, when it's the same Dhamma. The ones who are creating duality are the ones who are saying that my Dhamma is better than your Dhamma. Let's all just practice the Dhamma, Dukkha, Dukkha, Naroda. Let's not measure how the size of the boat. Let's just get in there and row.
Oh, a bird just flew in my room and hit. Oh. I never seen that happen before, so. Did you hear that?
So, does anybody else have anything to say? This has been a happy conversation. I really enjoyed this. Thank you, Carl, for joining us. My commissioner, do you have any last things to say?
That being teased by Dalmorado is a great way to see your attachments. Yeah.
What's a great way? I didn't catch that.
Being teased by you, by Dalmorado, is a great way to know where your attachments are.
I don't understand what you said. What about Damarato's got nothing to do with attachments? He's so attached, you wouldn't believe it.
No, I said being teased by you is a good way to know, like, where you're still holding on to certain attachments.
Ah, yes.
Yes. It's a great pedagogy you use.
Yeah. Yes, that's been a style that I've had all my life. It comes from a past life when I was a Mahayana. But I think that's in fact, actually, one place that I would say for sure is that Achan Po would tease me.
If there are buttons to be pushed.
Yeah, if there's buttons to be pushed, let's see those buttons.
If there's buttons to be pushing on our hut. When there's no buttons, you know.
Yeah, there was something that I used to say a long time ago. Don't say it anymore, but I used to say a long time ago that my buttons are so well hidden that only my mama knows where my buttons are. Because she could push them, but she's been dead these years now, so my buttons are still really well hidden. Nobody knows where my buttons are. Nobody knows the buttons I've seen. So, guys, this has been great. Michael Clark, do you have any last comments to make?
Thank you so much for your question today, David, and thank you everyone for your input. This has really been just a spectacular talk. And I'd like to remind people here today and the people listening online that we do have some volunteer opportunities, especially with opensangafoundation.org. Go ahead, log onto the website, make an account, check it out. We have 4,000 entries now, all sorts of watts to find and explore. We're also looking for volunteers for social media and our Discord server. So yeah, thank you everyone.
Yes. Michael Mishner, have you joined? Have you signed up for the website? No. I can see why you're looking in the air to see where you signed up.
No, because I had created an account and then I deleted it because I was going to recreate it, but I haven't recreated it yet. So
all right.
I'll do it.
Okay. Carl, you're invited to join our Open Sangha Foundation.
For sure. With pleasure. I haven't done it yet. I checked out the website, but we'll definitely join probably later today.
Okay. Actually, to be honest with you, all the best stuff is hidden behind. You have to sign up. You don't have to pay any money. There's not a paywall there, but there is a login. And that you can get to the whole site. Basically, it's an issue of security because emails and things like that are available, and we don't want Google to go crawling through the website. In fact, that's something that we've noticed quite recently is a lot of the stuff that we're looking up, what Open Sangha Foundation becomes the top of the list. So you want to know about this place, you go to Open Sangha Foundation to find out all about it. And we're the ones who are out there looking.
That's funny.
And okay, so that
sounds exciting. Definitely. I will create an account.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Thank you very much for this talk.
David, thank you again for your question. This has been quite a toy to play with today.
Yeah. Very interesting. I think I have to rewatch it.
Fine.
It's been pretty interesting.
Okay. We'll see you guys later. Thank you so much. This has been quite a joy.